from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny.
The Obamacare nightmare is about to end.
That was Vice President Mike Pence in Kentucky on Saturday extolling the GOP's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act as the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office prepares to release a report on the costs of the plan. Will it become a political nightmare for Republicans? Coming up on Forum, we talk with journalists about the latest political news, including the investigation into the Trump administration's Russian ties and the Fed's expected rate hikes this week. All coming up next after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum program. Intense debate continues over the GOP's plan to replace the Affordable Care Act as the Congressional Budget Office is set to issue a report as early as tomorrow on the plan's costs. In fact, that report may come out today. Meanwhile, the White House this week will release its proposed budget, which is expected to include deep cuts to popular domestic programs. And the Federal Reserve reportedly will raise a key interest rate Wednesday in response to strong jobs reports. At the same time, the Trump administration's Russia ties remain under tight congressional scrutiny, as Senator John McCain asserted on Sunday that there are, quote, a lot more shoes to drop from this centipede, end of quote. And the Department of Justice has until today to provide evidence supporting President Trump's claim that the Obama White House wiretapped Trump Tower. This hour, we discussed this news and more. Lots to cover here, a whole potpourri of really, in many ways, major news stories. We have a panel of journalists joining us. Let me tell you who they are. Stephen Kinzer is here with us in studio, world affairs columnist with the Boston Globe. He's also a senior fellow at the Watson Institute for International Public Affairs at Brown University and has a book out, The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. Stephen Kinzer, good to have you with us.
Good to be with you.
We also have Josh Gerstein with us. He's in Arlington, Virginia this morning. He's senior White House reporter for Politico. And welcome, Josh Gerstein.
Hey, Michael. Good to be back with you.
Good to have you back. And also good to have Kelsey Snell with us, who's a reporter with the Washington Post and joins us from the nation's capital. Welcome, Kelsey Snell.
Thank you so much for having me.
Glad to have you. And let me begin with you, Kelsey Snell, because, well, there's news that's unfolding as we're speaking about the Affordable Care Act. Actually, the Congressional Budget Office will put in a report probably today. And already Paul Ryan, to some extent, has sort of thrown up flares and caveats that maybe some of those numbers should not be entirely trusted. But I want to ask you about that, but also ask you the obvious question. At this point, can Ryan get the votes he needs from the GOP, particularly from his right wing?
I think that is the biggest and most pressing question of the week in terms of what will happen with the ACA. Conservatives are not happy, and they were telegraphing all through last week that they may not vote for this bill. And they repeated that kind of that sense that they are unhappy with the legislation throughout the Sunday shows yesterday and in phone calls to reporters all morning today. So I don't think it is a complete certainty that this bill, as it stands right now, will pass in Congress.
Well, it took 15 months for the last Affordable Care Act bill, so-called Obamacare, to get through. And there's been a lot of concern about how Trump supporters, those particularly without a lot of, shall we say, capital, are going to be the most hurt by this bill.
Yeah, I think that that is a very big open question is, you know, how much will people actually pay? Speaker says that the system that they're creating creates more incentives for insurance companies to compete against one another and drive down costs. They also want to eliminate things called essential health benefits, which have made plans more expensive. Those are things like guaranteed prenatal care and drug addiction care or free preventative services that were all part of the requirements in the Affordable Care Act. They are saying that by repealing those and allowing people to buy stripped-down policies, that they'll be cheaper for people. But we haven't seen what that actually looks like. All we've seen so far is that they want to scale back the subsidies and tax credits that are available to people and make them based on age, not just income.
Josh Gerstein, you want to weigh in on this?
Well, I agree with Kelsey. At the moment, it looks like that bill is in some trouble on Capitol Hill. There are even some senators who are saying they don't think that the House should vote on it. And it does seem we're getting indications that the White House is now open to making fairly major adjustments to the legislation in order to try to bring it across the finish line. The problem is that they're under pressure from both sides, so it's not immediately clear which direction they need to go in order to get this thing to move forward.
What direction do you think they're going to go on the travel ban? They've got some new legal issues that are arising. To some extent, they try to codify it and make it more palatable, but that doesn't seem to be washing either, does it?
Well, we'll see. We'll see if it washes with the federal judges that are going to look over this. We're looking at almost, I don't want to quite call it a train wreck of litigation over the next few days, but as someone who has to cover it, it's starting to seem that way to me. We have hearings already scheduled in Honolulu and in Maryland on Wednesday. We have a fight about whether to have a hearing in Virginia on Wednesday, and we think that Judge Robart, the one who issued the broadest block against the earlier travel ban order up out of Seattle, may well have a hearing of some sort before this travel ban 2.0, as people are calling it, is set to kick in on Thursday morning. Most experts think it is stronger, legally speaking, than the one Trump signed before, because, for example, it doesn't affect people who already have visas to visit the United States or to be in the United States. But, you know, critics of the order say it's still infected by the same prejudice, essentially, that President Trump showed during the campaign when he repeatedly called for a Muslim ban. The White House says this isn't a Muslim ban, but there's a question of whether that's sort of an original sin, if you will, that will infect any type of executive order the White House tries to issue on this subject. And that's one of the points judges are going to try to sort through in the coming few days.
And also, speaking of sorting through, Kelsey Snell, isn't today the day that the Trump administration is supposed to come up with some evidence, some at least demonstrable evidence that indeed Trump Tower was bugged?
Yeah, they are. This is the deadline for them to follow through on a request from a couple of senators, particularly Sheldon Whitehouse and Lindsey Graham, asked for details and evidence of the wiretapping, though we don't know if that will be made immediately public. My colleague Karen Demirjian is actually, I could see her across the way on the phone right now trying to figure out if they have met that deadline.
And also, I'm going to get to Stephen Kinzer about foreign affairs here, but let me go back, Josh Gerstein, to you for a moment, because there is a lot of brouhaha, not only about the firings of lawyers in the Department of Justice. That's to be expected. It happened when Bill Clinton came into office, and it's almost pro forma. But Preet Bharara is someone who apparently had talked to President Trump, and there was some agreement that he would indeed stay on. And yet he was fired. And there's also been reports, some pretty serious reports, about the Fox News being involved in some study, some investigation that he was doing. He was supposedly going after obtaining journalist phone records and also mail, supposed mail and phone wiring and things of that nature. Fraud, basically, having to do with Roger Ailes and sex harassment. In other words, we've got something that really is brewing here underneath the surface.
Yeah, I mean, as you were saying, Michael, it was sort of a broad-based dismissal. If anything, the complaint we heard from Democrats was that it was too broad-based, that basically it seemed that the White House was trying to force out all 46 holdover U.S. attorneys, the political appointees who had served or were appointed by President Obama, who remained in office, trying to force them all out basically by the end of the day. Friday, it later turned out that at least two of those U.S. attorneys have been given a reprieve, and we're still waiting to find out if there might be more. But you're quite right that most of the spotlight landed on Preet Bharara out of Manhattan, the Southern District of New York, who handles a lot of high-profile Wall Street cases and was pursuing this probe of Fox News, dealing both with something having to do with possibly obtaining voicemails or other records of journalists who cover Fox News, as well as this question of Fox News's business records related to Roger Ailes and how they might have potentially covered up settlement payments in that sexual harassment litigation and allegation. So, but, you know, I would say also Bharara is handling sensitive investigations at any time. He has a lot of prominent New York area political corruption investigations. And what's really weird about him being dismissed is that he met with Trump in Trump Tower in November and came out all smiles to meet with the media afterwards and said he'd been asked to stay on. So to sort of have him abruptly asked to leave about 6 weeks into the new administration, it was a little bit unexpected.
And again, Josh Gerstein is a senior White House reporter for Politico. Stephen Kinzer is World Affairs columnist with the Boston Globe. We're doing a kind of Monday political roundup here, and I want to hear from Stephen Kinzer, especially about what's moving along the trajectory with Russia. Senator McCain said over the weekend, you know, more revelations are bound to come, so he was predicting.
The demonization of Russia and Putin has gotten so extreme now that any sense of reality has left the room. The hacking scandal or allegations are only feeding into something that I think is pre-existing in Washington. And that's, first of all, the desire to have an enemy, but also the long history we have of considering our enemy as being in Moscow. America needs to find a great geopolitical threat. We've inflated Russia into this enormous predator that's after us, and Putin as the most evil figure the world has seen. So I think the Russia hacking and the questions of Trump's relations with Russia have had, besides their terrible effects on American politics, a negative effect on our foreign policy. It's now become almost impossible to stand up and suggest that maybe the United States should have a better relationship with Russia, or that it's not such a good idea for the United States to be carrying out military maneuvers right on Russia's border, which we would never tolerate in, say, Mexico or Canada. The idea of reconciliation with Russia is now taken as an acceptance of Russian interference in American politics. So we've essentially taken off the foreign policy table one of the key hopes that we had for positive change in the Trump administration.
What about the support of the Republicans on the platform, though, of sending lethal weapons to Ukraine, which was essentially not the wish of many Republicans? I mean, there are people who are trying to connect dots here, and I realize, I mean, there was an article in the Wall Street Journal that said a lot of these dots don't connect, but shouldn't there be just a kind of nonpartisan, if it's possible, investigation?
It would be great to see an investigation of what really happened. Everybody would like to know. And there are a lot of unanswered questions that even those of us who are skeptical of this whole propaganda wave would like to have answered. When you come to the question of American relations with Russia, which is about American intervention, should we be intervening in Georgia and in Ukraine and every place where somebody wants to do something against Moscow? Americans are truly divided. I don't think we've ever made up our minds as a nation whether we want to guide the world or whether we want every country to guide itself. Actually, we want both, even though they're opposites and you can't have both. So I think in many minds in Washington, there's this sense that we do want to confront Russia. We need to limit Russia. Russia's our enemy. On the other hand, there could be some reluctance to increase our military involvement in more wars since we've gotten into this situation over the last decade and a half where we're like a chain smoker that lights one cigarette from the last one. As soon as before one war is even over, we're into another one. And I think there is some fear that that could be what we might face if we get dragged into Ukraine, Syria, or other places where we are involved principally because we want to confront Russia.
Well, President Trump thinks that an alliance with Russia would help us defeat ISIS. I mean, clearly he's made those kinds of statements. But what do you make out of the fact that Michael Flynn is now a registered foreign agent for Turkey? I mean, what does that say about the vetting process?
Where they found Michael Flynn is really a mystery. And some of his statements are absolutely bizarre. He's come up with these ideas that Bolivia and Nicaragua and North Korea were in league with the jihadists to attack America. So I'm really relieved we got rid of that figure.
But there were Russian connections with Michael Flynn, too.
Absolutely. You talk about vetting. It's odd that a person who has been a lobbyist for foreign powers can then be considered seriously as a national security advisor without having done anything that seems to counterbalance that background. So the kinds of people that were seeing being brought into foreign policy positions in Washington is pretty terrifying. But even scarier than that is that in so many places, we're not bringing anyone in. A friend of mine gave a book talk at the State Department yesterday. He said it was packed. way more than he expected. And someone came up to him afterward and said, "We're all here because we literally have nothing to do." If you can imagine, last week, the State Department spokesman was asked what the foreign minister of Mexico was doing in Washington and who he was going to be meeting. And the spokesman said that he hadn't even been aware that the foreign minister of Mexico was in Washington. He was just there to meet with Jared Kushner and a couple of people in the White House. So the State Department, for the first time in my memory, has been marginalized from the making of foreign policy.
Well, there has been a lot of cuts in the State Department. In fact, Rex Tillerson has been argued the Secretary of State has had a kind of low profile. But let me go to you, Josh Gerstein, on this whole question of Russia. Can you explain what concerns are on both sides of the aisle with respect to Russia?
Well, you know, I have to say I found it fascinating. I was at a protest at the Justice Department last week where people were demanding Jeff Sessions' resignation, and this was a very liberal group. It was organized by Move On and involved the members of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, a number of whom prominent ones, I think, come from your state of California there. And this may be what Stephen was getting at earlier, the way that these folks were railing against the Russians and Russian influence in the U.S. government, and we can't have foreign countries interfering in our elections. You know, I honestly felt like I could have stumbled into a right-wing protest years ago using the same kind of language. So there's no question that on the left and among Democrats, there's really a fever pitch over this Russia issue. But it's also the case that people like Senator McCain, Senator Graham, and others on the Republican side have traditionally been very, very wary and distrustful of the Russians. And those people are trying to force some kind of, independent investigation here, despite some degree of resistance from the Trump White House. And then we also have something going on in parallel involving the Justice Department and the FBI, although the scope of it is not entirely clear. There are reports sometimes that there might not be as much as meets the eye to this either criminal or intelligence investigation that the FBI and the Justice Department has been conducting. You know, was it a matter of exploring how Russians may have been trying to influence Trump's campaign, as well as obviously the hacking and things along those lines with Hillary Clinton's campaign? Or was there some concern that actual campaign operatives were agents of Russia? And that's where things are very, very murky at this point. Are we talking about people in the periphery that might have been, you know, sucking up, for lack of a better term, to the campaign? Or are we talking about some concern that there were actual people that were somehow, for some strange reason, in the pocket of the Russians? And that's what is open-ended.
Once again, Josh Gerstein is senior White House reporter for Politico, and Stephen Kinzer is world affairs columnist for the Boston Globe. Let me go to another area of great concern here that's murky with you, Stephen Kinzer. That has to do, again, with North Korea, but South Korea is now apparently going to be under new leadership. There's been an impeachment. Some speculation is there's going to be softer diplomacy toward the North under this new leadership, whether that's going to be true or not. What kind of options does President Trump have? I mean, the missile armaments just keep expanding and tests underground. We talked about this last week on Forum, but what kind of options does really President Trump have, or for that matter, does his administration have here?
North Korea is a particularly difficult conundrum. I do think the United States is active in cyber warfare against that nuclear program quite intensely, and I've seen a lot of their missiles falling into the sea soon after being launched, so I think that's not just
an accident. What they did with Iran.
Exactly. On the other hand, I think that in a larger framework, the only way that the North Korea problem can be addressed other than by direct military attack is in concert with the other countries in the area. The United States has to work with the new government in South Korea, with Japan, and particularly with China. The Chinese are extremely upset at the deployment of a new missile defense system by the United States in South Korea. They see that as a direct attack on their security, and they see the United States trying to encircle China with military installations, much as we have with Russia. That is going to be a great obstacle in securing Chinese cooperation in any efforts to pressure North Korea. The Chinese are afraid, of course, that if North Korean government falls and there's unification of Korea, you're going to have American troops right on the border with China. They don't want that. So some kind of a structure would have to be agreed upon by the countries in the neighborhood that would allow us to present some kind of a carrot and stick project to North Korea. Unfortunately, the North Koreans have not shown themselves to be particularly open to rational dialogue. It takes the Chinese on board, and our recent actions in South Korea have made it all but impossible for the Chinese to get on board at this time.
But what the Chinese have done with coal, of course, gives them perhaps less leverage. And nevertheless, we also have that anti-missile shield being compared to the Cuban Missile Crisis. I mean, this is a pretty volatile situation, like you say, a conundrum, and I don't see where it can go, but perhaps there are people a lot smarter. I hope there are people a lot smarter than I am in this. Let me go back to you, Kelsey Snell. I want to talk about something closer to home with you. This week, the Trump administration is expected to be rolling back strict limits on carbon pollution for both cars and trucks. And according to our own Carolyn Lockhead of the Chronicle, they're actually considering a plan to essentially rewrite California authority to set its pollution standards. What do we know?
Well, you know, I would say that what we do know is that the White House has shown a strong willingness to take as many actions as possible through the executive branch. And this is one of those things where we kind of are waiting and seeing exactly how they will execute it. Because as we saw with the travel ban and with other actions that they've taken, they telegraph the general idea of what they want to do without the details. And at this point, we really just don't have a ton of detail to go from. What I do know from talking to people about the EPA specifically is they expect this to pair with other budget cuts that they are planning on energy and environment to, you know, to scale back a lot of regulations with the hope, they say, of giving companies more and more latitude and more ability to, you know, to profit, essentially. And, you know, the outcomes of the actual environmental impact are very unclear.
Well, we're taking up a lot of topics here in this Monday political roundup, and I know many of you would certainly like to weigh in on not only with questions about what we've broached here, but also with comments. And I invite you to do that now. In fact, we would really much like to hear from you on anything we've been discussing, the Affordable Care Act, Russia, and whether there should be an independent investigation. As I said, today is supposed to be the day that President Trump is allegedly going to come forward, or was asked to come forward, with some evidence about Trump Tower being hacked and his phones being hacked, and talking about, once again, North Korea. So much to cover and much to hear from you on. So let me give you the phone number to call if you have something you'd like to contribute to this conversation, or if you have a question. You can join us now, and the toll-free number to do that is 866-733-6786. Again, we invite your calls. Please feel free to join the program. Toll free, 866-733-6786. If you have a comment on anything we've been discussing in the news, or if you have a question, we do want to hear from you. You can also email us, forum@kqed.org, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or simply go right to our website, kqed.org/forum, and click on the segment. Talking with Steve Kinzer, who's here with us in studio, world affairs columnist for the Boston Globe, with Josh Gerstein, who is senior White House reporter with Politico, and with Kelsey Snell, who's a reporter with the Washington Post. We'll hear from you when we return. We do want your comments and questions. Join the program. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We are covering a lot here on this Monday morning political roundup because there is indeed a lot to cover. I've been talking about the Affordable Care Act and about the travel ban and about the ongoing desire to have a serious investigation of Russian involvement in the campaign and much more. And we do want to hear from you, so feel free to join the program. You can do that by calling us at our toll-free number, 866-733-6786, or emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or tweeting us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum, or feel free, of course, to go on our website, kqed.org/forum. Stephen Kinzer's here in studio. He's a world affairs columnist with the Boston Globe and has a new book out called The True Flag, Theodore Roosevelt, Mark Twain, and the Birth of American Empire. Josh Gerstein's with us by phone. He's White House reporter with Politico. And Kelsey Snell is with us, also by phone, Washington Post reporter. And I'm going to go to your calls and emails here. Let me just first ask you, Kelsey Snell, if I may. I'd be remiss if I didn't get a quick sense of your pulse or your feeling about the pulse of the economy, particularly in light of the fact that we're talking about a raising of interest rates now, and the job report came out, and it looks good, and President Trump is trying to take credit for it. Give us an overall sense of what you're hearing in Washington.
Well, presidents love to take credit for good jobs reports when they are good, and they love to say that it was not their fault when they go bad. And in fact, the economy is a very complicated thing, and it's difficult to say whether or not a jobs report that, like we saw last week, you know, what the exact root of a good number like that is. I would point out, though, that Republicans were previously dismissing jobs numbers when it looked like they were, you know, they were doing well for President Obama. It does appear that the economy is improving. And, you know, that's actually a trend that's been going on for quite a while now. The question remains that, you know, how will people individually be impacted by that? Is economic growth going to trickle down to people who lost jobs, who stopped looking for jobs, or who are underemployed? And I think those are the people who we saw become very animated by the promises made by President Trump. So I think we're going to need to see a few more cycles of job numbers and a little bit more information, you know, on people's what type of jobs people are taking and real wage growth before we know how exactly the economy is shaking out.
Well, but there is a kind of post-election bullishness, whether it's a little too premature or not, we need to kind of assess. But there's a lot of talk about raising interest rates. What do you think? It's going to happen?
I mean, they've been telegraphing for some time that interest rates are going to go up. And I imagine that, yes, that will occur sometime within the next year. There is a sense of worry about, you know, being a little too cautious right now. But, yeah, probably in the near future, you will see interest rates go up. And I think that this long process of getting to that point was intended to get people as prepared as possible.
Let me go back before I go to our callers, Josh Gerstein, to you. This is Farah who writes, all of this talk about Trump's wiretapping allegation is distracting from the scandal with Jeff Sessions. Maybe also distracting from much more than that. What are your thoughts?
Well, you know, that's a vein of analysis or criticism we've heard since really the transition period, that every time something seemingly outrageous is reported, that it's a distraction from every other story that we're supposed to be doing. I don't know that there's a huge scandal at the moment in the Jeff Sessions situation, except there was that part of the Russia story that rotated around Sessions, the fact that he had had at least two meetings with the Russian ambassador in advance of the election, and somehow when asked a question that seemed to bear on that topic during his confirmation hearings, neglected to mention the fact that he had had those meetings. Then it was brought out by the media, by the Washington Post, in fact, just a week or so ago, and that did really pull Sessions into this Russia story. Also made it clear that he was going to recuse himself completely from any ongoing investigations that the Justice Department or the FBI have into that matter. And now we're sort of waiting to hear whether there's still a possibility of to handle the criminal side of this, if there is one, a special counsel, or will the Justice Department try to keep this matter in-house? I don't think we'll get a decision on that very soon. We're waiting for the number two official at Justice to be confirmed by the Senate, and then we'll probably get some kind of ruling about whether they want to keep that investigation in-house or whether they're going to farm it out to some form of special prosecutor.
And Stephen Kinzer, could I get you just to comment quickly on something else that came up over this past week, really, and that is a 20-minute conversation between President Trump and Mahmoud Abbas. I mean, it would appear, in fact, that there's an invitation that's been extended to Mahmoud Abbas, Abu Mazen, to come to the White House. There are all kinds of invitations, in fact, coming into fruition. We're going to get a visit by Angela Merkel. We got a visit by the leader of China coming up. What about the Palestinian leader?
First of all, Abbas is no longer seen by most Palestinians, I think, as a true leader of their cause. He's overstayed his welcome by many years. He's actually not even constitutionally in office as head of the Palestinian Authority. On the other hand, he's the interlocutor that we've chosen. We've decided that the political leadership in Gaza, for example, is not acceptable for us as a partner to talk. So if Trump wants to talk to Abu Mazen, I think it's great. I'm not enthusiastic about prospects that might happen. On the other hand, we've been on a more or less steady path with Israel and the Palestinians now for decades. Trump might throw a bomb into the whole process. You have no idea what's going on in his head. And I think...
Remember he said two states, one state, we'll see what happens?
Exactly. And if I were sitting in Israel, I wouldn't be so confident. All of the comments that he's made about how much he loves Israel could be a setup for something else. And in addition, the kind of divisive policies that Trump is following inside the United States of pitting groups against each other and warning people in America about minorities ultimately can be very dangerous to Jews. And I'm sure, I know that people in Israel are already worrying about this and questioning whether, in the larger sense, Trump really is their friend.
Let's go to your calls and let's begin with Stephen joining us from San Rafael. Hi, Stephen. You're on the air.
Yes, good morning. I wanted to ask a question about the Trump administration vis-a-vis the Emoluments Clause of the Constitution. It seems like it sort of disappeared from the news lately, but my understanding was that he did not adequately separate himself from his business interests, and there already seems to be conflicts evidenced, as, for example, the recent granting of 38 permits by the Chinese for Trump products and businesses. And I just wondered, why is this not even in the news anymore if he is, in fact, in violation of that Emoluments Clause of the Constitution? I'll take your comments off the air.
All right. I thank you for that. There's still political push on this, Josh Gerstein, I know, isn't there?
Yeah, there sure is. I mean, I would defend the media for a moment by saying that obviously the caller's learning about this from somewhere, so it is somewhere in the news. I think the reason there's been a bit of a lull is there were a couple of lawsuits that were filed up in New York City over this emoluments issue, trying to challenge them in court, and those are sort of in pretrial proceedings now and are headed towards motions to dismiss that the government has filed or is expected to file in the coming weeks. So that's sort of being hashed out up there. We had another case filed in Washington, I think just last week, of a restaurant that claimed that their business is being taken away illegally, or that the subject of illegal competition, what you folks call there in California, unfair competition from the Trump hotel in Washington, and they've filed new litigation over that. And I have heard these allegations about the Chinese trademarks being issued. It's still something that's out there. All I can say is there's a lot to cover surrounding the Trump administration. And so sometimes you see some of these issues like Russia or the dismissal of the U.S. attorneys jump into the news and perhaps drown out some of the other things that are going on.
Anything to shed light from your perspective, Stephen Kinzer here?
No, I think it's true that you're always going to have this push-pull of news stories. At least Trump has taught us some new words. We didn't even know how to pronounce misogyny or emoluments, but now our vocabulary is expanding, which is not something we expected with Trump.
We'll go to more of your calls. Let me go next to you. Clifton, you're on the air.
Hi. Wonderful piece. Well, wonderful, kind of terrifying piece, as there are so many out there, on the Trump Project in Azerbaijan in New Yorker recently. So it looks like there's a way to tie the Trump organization to the Iran Revolutionary Guard through financing of this hotel, which never opened, something completely mired in corruption. So are these sorts of stories likely to ever get, there's so many of them, but this one looks particularly bad. We're consorting with people who are our deadly enemies. So what's your opinion on this one?
Stephen Kinzer.
I think that with Iran, we're in a situation somewhat similar to the one we're in with Russia. I did see that piece about that odd project in Azerbaijan that some Iranians might have been involved with, along with Trump. But what I fear now is that just as the so-called scandal about Russia's involvement in our elections has pushed the idea of diplomacy with Russia off the table, even though diplomacy with Russia is a much bigger, longer-term issue than what happened in this election, the same thing is happening with Iran. The possibility that the United States might try to develop a new, more cooperative relationship with Iran seems now to be made almost impossible by these other allegations. So Trump is really the most imperfect of messengers for the idea of a new foreign policy. He's actually made it impossible because of his past business and political dealings for the United States to deal directly with some of its major foreign policy challenges.
Let me thank the caller, and let me go to another caller. That's you, Simon. You're on the air.
Hi, how are you today?
Okay, thank you.
I had a question for one of your guests, or rather a request. If you could clarify whether or not you can actually demonize Russia at this point. And, you know, this is a country that annexed a part of a sovereign country to itself. I don't know anything about the elections, and I just think that it's worth, you know, finding out what had happened there. But this is also a country where on major TV stations, there's a gentleman who says that this is the only country that can make the United States a nuclear desert. Can we really demonize it at this point?
Yes, we can. The United States and Russia and China are the major powers in this world. It's very important for the United States to try to develop cooperative relationships with them. Russia is seeking to maintain a sphere of influence around its borders. It doesn't want enemies right on its border. That's what we in international relations call strategic depth. They're trying to do what we've been doing in the Caribbean and the Central America for more than a century. If the Ukrainians want partners in suffering, let them look to the Hondurans and the Dominicans and others who have lived under the shadow of a big power. The fact is that despite those nice-sounding Westphalian principles, and when you're a small country living right next to a real big power, your foreign policy options are limited. Now, we need some kind of new security architecture for Central Europe that would involve Russia, the United States, NATO, and the countries in that region. We need some new rules of the road. That situation with Russia is intensifying too fast. We are really on a path for confrontation with Russia, and there's no real reason for this. The problems we have with Russia have to do with Russia's neighborhood. In addition to what we say may be Russia's involvement in our election campaign, something which involvement in other countries' election campaigns, of course, being something the United States has a lot of experience with. So, yes, I think it is possible to go over the top. Russia is not our friend, and Putin is not our ally or an admirable leader. I find it very distressing that Trump has tied together, however, the idea that we should have better relations with Russia and the idea that Putin is a great leader and his leadership style is wonderful. They don't go together. Diplomacy is not about affection. You don't need to like the leader or like the country. Diplomacy is all about advancing national interest. And it's in the interest of the United States to reduce the level of confrontation with Russia.
Let me go back to you, Josh Gerstein, on this because I'm looking at a comment from a listener named Tom who brings up Roger Stone, Trump's former campaign manager, and his apparent collusion with Juicifer 2.0, who claimed to orchestrate the DNC hacks. It seems like, according to this listener, the closest thing to a smoking gun we've seen yet, but no real noise being made. And these are, again, some of the allegations that have been made.
Right.
And maybe you might tell us a little bit more about Guccifer, if you could.
Yeah. So the latest twist here is that Roger Stone has acknowledged that he had, I believe it was a private Twitter exchange with people who claim to be involved with the Russia hack. I think that involved this person who calls himself Guccifer 2.0, although I don't think we've clearly identified for sure who really was involved in that Russian hack, which ended up, of course, with WikiLeaks. But there had been allegations through the campaign based on things that Stone had said publicly that he had some kind of heads up that particularly the hack of the Clinton campaign chairman John Podesta's email, that he knew that was coming in advance. And now it seems like that comes from some kind of private Twitter exchange.
I also should mention here, I think I'd be remiss if I didn't, you had Carter Page, who was a close ally and advisor to Trump, talking about the so-called annexation of Crimea.
Right. So there are several people in Trump's orbit during the campaign. Carter Page is one. Paul Manafort is another.
Manafort was giving advice to Yanukovych, who was the leader of Ukraine and who was essentially a Putin puppet, really. Yeah.
Right, and so there are questions about their financial relationships, their potential relationships with Russia, their relationships with other individuals who some people think may have been Russian intelligence operatives, and it's just curious that those relationships were all being built up publicly, that there were these meetings going on with the ambassador in Washington, and you had the hacking all going on at the same time as part of what, you know, intelligence officials refer to as an influence campaign aimed at, you know, disrupting or altering the outcome of the U.S. Presidential election. As far as we understand it, though, these things have sort of been disaggregated for the purposes of these criminal investigations, with the hacking being sort of one thing that is being investigated, and then the intelligence and influence efforts and potential ties of people in Trump's orbit to Russian officials, Russian operatives, being investigated as sort of a separate matter. And what will come of those investigations, I don't know. And obviously that's parallel to anything Congress is doing, which the two intelligence committees are pursuing their own.
Yeah, Stephen Kinzer wants in here, Stephen.
I just want to add one other thought, and that is that I hope one result of this firestorm in Washington is not going to be that members of Congress are not going to want to meet with foreign ambassadors anymore. That should be a part of their job. You'd want your senator to be meeting every week with the ambassador of another country. That's how we find out about the world, other than by traveling. So let's hope that the idea that members of Congress should talk to the Russian ambassador or the ambassador of any other country does not become something negative in American politics. We're not engaged enough with diplomats in Washington. We're not learning enough about the outside world. So let's not seal ourselves off even more in order to avoid political criticism that a member of Congress has been seen dining with an ambassador.
Well, there's going to be a big rollout this week of a Republican proposed budget. And I'm wondering, Kelsey Snell, if you could give us a sense of how America First, including, you know, foreign aid and money being poured into so many other things internationally, is, for that matter, going to play itself out.
Well, one thing to remember about this whole idea of America First is that Trump has focused that mostly on military and a whole lot less on things like, you know, protection against viruses or CDC research abroad. And that has raised some concerns in the budget community that there may be major cuts to domestic programs that actually support, you know, the U.S.'s protection abroad. I think you'll also be seeing a little bit more of this deep cutting to the federal workforce that Trump had kind of already telegraphed. We had a story up earlier this week kind of looking at those big rollbacks that the administration is looking at. I think that we've already been told we're going to see increases in military spending, but those have not been enough for some of the biggest defense hawks in Congress. We've already heard Senator John McCain and others say that, you know, a small plus up over what the Obama administration proposed is just falling short of what their expectations are. So it may be that Trump puts out a budget this week and disappoints both Democrats and Republicans. I know that Democrats are already preparing to be angry about cuts to domestic spending, though I will remind people, this is a bit of my soapbox that I get on when it comes to budget, is that the president puts out a budget request. It is not an actual detailed list of the way that spending will happen. Congress handles all of the spending, and White House budgets have always been a kind of campaign document, a blueprint that says, this is in my dream scenario as president, what I would like to do. Trump is going to follow that same exact pattern, and Congress will respond by doing their own separate budget later. And even Congress's budget is not what spending will be enacted. Spending is done through a completely different process known as appropriations. So we get very worked up when we see numbers come out of a White House, but it's important to remember that that is not the final way the federal government will spend money.
Kelsey, I have another question for you, but I'm going to read a couple of listener comments. Here's a tweet that says, Trump claims he inherited a mess. Imagine if this administration was also dealing with the jobs numbers Obama had. And Rick writes, I would say that the dictator in North Korea is the most immediate threat to the U.S., not Russia. Kim Jong-un launched 4 ballistic missiles into Japan's waters, and Russia has done nothing but talk. Here's a question about immigration, and I'd like to go to you on this if I could, Kelsey Snell. Skip writes, the president has the power to restrict visas and to refuse entry to any foreigner. The fact that he exercises this power is not a problem for me. What does bother me is the fact that in many ways our border is run by the drug cartels and that visa-less foreigners have rights in this country. It doesn't bother me that we have enforcement of our immigration laws.
Well, so the thing that I think is important to remember is that we don't – the visa-less travel idea is one that's been up for a lot of debate in Congress. And it's part of our agreements that we have because travel and access for people to come and go from the country is not just a matter of, you know, hard security. It's also a matter of, you know, part of our trade policy, the agreements that we get into across borders about the economy. And it is – immigration and travel are not purely a homeland security enforcement. And I think that's something that sometimes gets entangled in a way that people don't think about, is that we do a lot of our negotiations with country not just about whether or not we have weapons or have boots on the ground, but it's also, you know, the ability to travel and visit a country and the ability to, you know, to be here through, you know, flying in or driving in is a part of the way that we kind of communicate our relationship with the world. So I think that's something that people are struggling with right now, is how and when do you enforce that, and what are the appropriate boundaries of enforcement?
I do want to get to more of your calls and emails. But first, let me go back to you, Josh Gerstein. I want to cover something else here that we haven't even broached yet. Voting rights. In Texas, there was a federal court ruling that some districts in Texas are violating the Voting Rights Act. Shed some light on this for us, can you?
Yeah, that was another of a flurry of news developments we had on Friday night, a decision that race had played an improper role in several congressional districts that had been drawn in Texas back in 2011. My understanding is that some of those districts aren't currently being used, but it's the kind of ruling that I think also calls attention to the fact that the Trump administration is in the process of shifting the federal government's role in enforcing voting rights laws. There's another case pending in Texas over their voter ID law, which the Obama administration had been strongly against and had sued over. And the Trump administration, when they had the chance, basically backed away from that position just days after coming into office. And so it's going to be increasingly left to civil rights groups, I think, to private litigants to try to enforce these laws as best they can through the courts, where they think that redistricting, for example, or voter ID laws or what have you, are being used to discriminate against minorities, because the Trump Justice Department, I think, is going to have probably a narrower view of what those laws mean and where they should be enforced.
And here's a caller with a question for our guest, Stephen Kinzer. Go ahead, Argyris, you're on the air.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
So, very quick question for Stephen. He seems to be pretty skeptical about the idea that there was active Russian involvement in the latest U.S. election. So I was just wondering, like, for a West Coast liberal like myself, that's almost taken for granted at this point, what does he think, like, is the evidence that points that that might not be the case? And I'll take my answer over here. Thank you.
All right. Thank you.
I don't want to pose as an expert on what really happened during the election, what was going on that we didn't see between Russia and the Trump campaign. I don't know what's going to come out. What I lament is that this firestorm over the hacking has overwhelmed what I think is a much more important issue, and that is U.S.-Russia relations. That's practically off the table now. The other thing I would add, since we were just talking about the new budget proposal, is that our budget that we've – the budget proposal we've seen from Trump has not only great increases in military spending, which I expect and understand even though I don't like it, but a dramatic cut in the State Department. We have 1.2 million soldiers in uniform. We have 15,000 diplomats. It's a great imbalance. The United States has a great story to tell in the world, but we're not telling it. And Trump is undermining, by these kinds of budget cuts in the State Department, the ability of the United States to project its power in the best way we can, which is our example, our story. Nobody in the world wishes they could live like Russia. People don't admire China. They do admire us. We have a story to tell, and Trump's State Department cuts are greatly hurting our ability to tell it.
Can I get Kelsey Snell, you to weigh in on the cuts in the State Department?
You know, the cuts to the State Department, again, it is one of those situations where, like I said, this is a proposal from the White House, and it's not entirely clear to me how this will play out with the way that Congress appropriates money to the different agencies. Though it does communicate a strong preference from the Trump administration about what their priorities are and the way that they want to handle, you know, foreign affairs. That said, I don't imagine Congress is really going to push back too much on a budget request like this. So I think we will see over the next 3-4 months exactly how the spending will break down over the next year. And I think that, you know, you will see a lot of Democrats and Republicans push back on the idea that soft power is not important.
We have very little time left here, but Josh Gerstein, we started with the Affordable Care Act, and let me go back to that with a listener question having to do somewhat with politics. Gary writes, for about 7 years, Republicans have been unified in ranting against Obamacare and promises to repeal it. Now they're obviously floundering with a defective bill that is highly unlikely to satisfy the Republican caucus, much less anyone else. Why did they fail to use that 7 years to develop and refine a replacement bill?
Well, I mean, there was no need to achieve consensus during that period. It was relatively a cheap stunt politically to be able to vote to repeal a piece of legislation that you knew wasn't going to be repealed. And there's pretty strong, it's not just a question of formulating a bill. I mean, there's a major difference in opinion between sort of moderate Republicans who are concerned and some governors who are concerned about the damage to state Medicaid programs and very conservative Republicans who say, I think probably fairly rightly, that a refundable tax credit that gives people money to purchase insurance much the way Obamacare does, although smaller amounts of money, is some sort of an entitlement program or a handout. And so those two views may not be completely compatible, and they were sort of pushed under the waves during the last 8 years. And in the last few months, they've had to grapple with that disagreement.
We'll have to leave it there. Josh Gerstein, good to have you with us. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Josh Gerstein again, senior White House reporter of Political. And thank you, Kelsey Snell, reporter of The Washington Post. Good to have you aboard here this morning.
Great to be here. Thanks so much.
And thank you, Stephen Kinzer, who joined us in studio, World Affairs columnist for the Boston Globe. Thank you, Stephen.
Nice to be in the studio.
Another hour ahead, we're going to talk to the former head of the CIA.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation, and by Jan Schramm and Maria Minetti Schramm, founders of the Minetti Schramm Museum of Art at UC Davis, which preserves the legacy of renowned artists such as Wayne Thiebaud for future innovators by dedicating a third of its space to arts education.